I'm Christopher Lydon with the offbeat oracle of the Arkansas Ozarks, C.D. Wright. She is slipping us back 40 years to the small town South and an obscure little hinge of American history when Sweet Willie Wine led a black march against fear through her town. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is history rendered as poetry. C.D. Wright has contrived her own medium to tell this story. It can feel like documentary history here and there or old-time storytelling, but it came out as one long poem in the book, One With Others, that was a finalist for the National Book Award for Poetry late last year, and last week won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Congratulations, C.D. Wright, and welcome back to Open Source.
Thank you, Chris. I'm very pleased to be back.
Good. With new laurels, too.
Well, that was a very pleasing award because this book is, well, and it, most of my writing is, but this book may be exceptionally very much in the vernacular. It's very localized, and it's set in a very particular time, 1969, in the Arkansas Delta. The civil rights era has been very exhaustively and beautifully documented and might not be considered a subject that's on and burning right now. So that pleased me. And I was also focused on a very anonymous woman and that I was able to vivify her enough for that to mean something to someone else was very gratifying.
C.D. Wright, so many particulars contribute to the feeling of the time and the place that you're evoking. Just a few of the dots that I think have to be mentioned and connected before we're done are these. Elvis Presley and Sonny Liston, the Texas-Arkansas football game of the century, they called it, LBJ, and Richard Nixon in the stands, Bill Clinton listening on the radio in England. There are images of Sweet Betsy blooming and walnuts turning dark in the grass. Martin Luther King Jr. is a giant figure in the near background. He was assassinated just a year before your story. And then there's the one white woman that you call V, who had joined the Black March for Freedom. C.D. Wright, tell us this story.
Well, this town, it was one of many in the Delta that more or less exploded in the months leading up to and in the year or two after King's death. King was assassinated but about 42 miles from this town and only a year before, and that was a very long, drawn-out struggle leading up to his assassination, the garbage strike. So this part of the country was as ill at ease as any part of the country could be at that time. The most terrible things did not really happen in this town, but, I mean, there were not, as far as I know, people executed in this town. What did happen was that there were a number of protests in the black schools about conditions in the black schools. And one of these was a march to the white school by high school students where they came to the campus grounds of the white school, linked arms, sang like a tree planted by the water, and there was a mass arrest. Actually, following the mass arrest, they didn't know what to do with these kids. There was certainly not a jail that would house 100-and-something kids in a small town. So then it occurred to them that they could put them in the swimming pool, which was supposedly the public swimming pool, but which was for whites only. The pool had been drained for the season, so they put them in the pool by day. By night, they moved them into the Civic Center. And they were made to watch Tarzan while the police gesticulated sort of ape sounds at them. And it was very scary and very humiliating and many of the students just were very proud to be part of a collective action, and most of them not only recovered, it became a great moment for them. After that, there was a march led by Sweet Willie Wine, who was a member of an organization called the Invaders from Memphis. They were not much more than a gang, really, but they became politicized after Martin Luther King's assassination and during the garbage strike in Memphis. They came over to organize the boycott, which they did, and after all of these incidents, Sweet Willie Wine led a march against fear from West Memphis to Little Rock.
That's how far?
That's about 150 miles.
Mm.
In the heat, so that can be a pretty hot, long march. My friend, about whom the book is centered, was the only white woman involved in this demonstration.
This is the fabled V.
This was my very iconoclastic friend V, a very self-educated, nonconformist, brilliant, hilarious woman who was married to a man with whom she was thoroughly incompatible and with whom she had seven children, and she had no money. And so when she crossed the line and got involved in all of the actions that were going on in Forest City, she was arrested, and her car was burned up in the police parking lot. Her husband denounced her on the radio, divorced her, took custody of the children, and she was run out of the town, out of the state, driven out of the state by the governor, Winthrop Rockefeller's bodyguard.
This is a woman who could quote William Butler Yeats on anything. You call her your Goomba. You say she's the woman who made you a writer. Let's get into V.
Well, she had just devoured books as a child. She grew up outside of Louisville and then in Louisville, Kentucky. Her father was a very erudite man. And so books were very much a part of, they were her familiars. She was an only child. Her mother died when she was three. So, and her memory was extensive. So she could quote everything that she had read, and she could drop these quotations into seamless sentences about everything else, either about some legislator she was mad at or some thing going on in the school about whether kids should wear uniforms, or it could be anything. It could be, she drew on everything. She was easily inflamed, but she also could convert that into a great reservoir of humor.
You write about V. C.D. She loved words, cats, long playing records, laughter, men, alcohol, cigarettes, the supernatural. It makes for a carnal list, pointless to rank, five in diapers at once, a stench she claimed she never got used to.
Right. She was not a happy mother of seven.
Is there such a thing?
Yeah, I can't quite imagine. It was certainly not without more help than she was able to have, although she did eventually have a babysitter who helped her a number of hours a day. And it was that woman's granddaughter who was among the children arrested, and that was the spark that ignited V around this issue.
You write that V was a Catholic under protest. She said it makes martyrs of the women and emasculates the men. She also said an amazing line, if religion is the opiate of the masses, fundamentalism is the amphetamine.
She meant it, too. After I had finished the book, a mutual friend of ours said that V had told him that if she could give her children back anything, it would be their foreskins. She had a very elaborate altar set up in her one-room apartment in Hell's Kitchen.
This was
her exile. This was actually her homecoming since she was born in Brooklyn. but only lived there for a matter of months. So she was always attracted to the spiritual life and the supernatural. And so she had her own religion that she cobbled together from a number of other religions. And I'm sure it had very Catholic elements, but I couldn't tell you exactly what those were because she would get so agitated around the church.
You know, we laugh at so many of these amazing lines. Was she a funny person to be with?
Oh, she was killingly funny. She was irresistibly funny, and she was a magnet, people loved to be in her company. Because also she could find the humor in the most awful things, which made them more tolerable.
For example?
Well, she would get really mad about either something some priest had done or some legislator had done, and she would jump up and say she would like to saw that MF in half left-handed. You know, assumedly because that would hurt more. I mean, we thought that was funny.
Here's V, born in Brooklyn, Irish blood, grew up in Kentucky, living in the Arkansas Delta. What was her connection to the Black Freedom thing?
She had always identified herself as an underdog. She had an enormous sense of justice. She was a very ethical person. She was brutally honest. She was passionate about people having inalienable rights. There was just no ifs, ands, and buts about it for her. There was no middle ground.
CD, there are so many brilliant lines here about V or from V. Give us a few. Start anywhere.
In Hell's Kitchen, her apartment is smaller by half than the shotgun shacks that used to stubble the fields outside of Big Tree, stained from decades of nonstop smoking. The world, according to V, was full of smoke and void of mirrors. She was not an eccentric. She was an original. She was congenitally incapable of conforming. She was resolutely resistant. She was my Goomba. Cats, Catholicism, alcohol, and men, she served them all. Children, she failed her own. Of that, she was acutely aware. It was the grief of her existence. If I could summon her Loa now, if this were her book of days, if she were still able to sit back on her double joints and read my cards, sometimes you feel rather alone in the world. Times of stress and dissatisfaction are likewise times of passion. If she were able to pass through that wall this very second. V, what spurred you to get involved? It was when they put the kids in the swimming pool. My babysitter's granddaughter. They put her in the pool. I knew some kids over at Memphis State, and they put me in touch with the invaders. I met one invader, and he wouldn't have anything to do with me. I wanted them to come over and help. After I was driven out of Arkansas, I went to the FBI office in Memphis. He said, "What are you going to do? You know, you're not stupid." I said, "I don't know." He said, "Why don't you take the civil service test?" I took the civil service telephone operator's test, and I was the top passer. I got a letter back that said, "With your infamous acts, there is no way we would employ you." It was creepy. I wish I'd kept that letter. I could have probably sued them. I could have gone to Europe and lived a while. She was guilty of no fear, no envy, no meanness. And when, if once in a knocked-up-again moon, she felt a twinge of desire for a certain silk blouse, she was sure to touch the wearer, to touch the other on the sleeves, that she not be afflicted by any shallow tendencies. I remember her in livid color, her with the radiant, cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy, the best mind of a generation in an era, a place that thought nothing of a woman, even a white woman, and of a Black woman thought even less. Of course, the Blake-like line is Ginsberg's famous opening for Howl. Something else, lie, was not in her vocabulary. the pure inflammatory truth, she could take it. And gentle reader, she knew how to inflict it.
You pick up so many wonderful lines from Allen Ginsberg, but also Sweet Willie Wine. He says, if white people can ride down their highways with guns, I can walk down the highway unarmed.
Right.
What did your friends and neighbors from that time, your high school classmates, remember of all this?
Well, Chris, I was from the other part of the state. I didn't grow up in this town. I grew up in the Arkansas Ozarks, which was all white to begin with, except for a small pocket of African Americans in Fayetteville, where the university was. I did not grow up in the Arkansas Delta, which is a very, very different part of the world, really, from hill country. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was cotton, soybeans, rice. This was plantation land. That was the South. The Ozarks, I always called the Upper South. It really wasn't part of Southern culture in that way. It was part of hill culture, mountain culture. Mm. The Appalachians, the Smokies, the Ozarks, that was all very, very similar kind of part of the world.
But I'm wondering, how did the kids from the black high school, from the white high school, from the sheriff's department, Sweet Willie Wine, how have they processed this very, very poignant and touching and important piece of history?
Most of them, I think, felt somewhat like V did. V said it was the most alive she ever felt. Mm. I think they felt like they had been part of something where they claimed their inalienable rights. And I think some people, of course, were very embittered by it, and their racism was not to be dislodged by anything that happened. But, I mean, I met a woman who lived next door to V, who still lives in the house that is next door to where V lived. She came out to pick up a newspaper when I was out in front of V's empty house, and I asked her if she knew her. And she said, oh, yes, I knew her. She said she didn't trust me. I didn't trust her. She stuck to herself. And then she said, this was a white woman, she said, it was such a confusing time. She said, they were right. We were wrong. And I was very impressed by that. Though a couple of sentences later, she said, they have souls just like us. And I was also quite impressed by that remark.
In researching this poem, C.D. Wright, you went back. What did you find? What's happened to Delta, Arkansas in the meantime?
Well, the Delta used to be the richest part of the state. Now, I would say the Ozarks is the richest part of the state, and the Delta is by far the poorest part of the state. The economy shifted hugely. The major manufacturing industries left, and the land, to a great extent, became depleted. The rivers became very polluted. It was a fishing and hunting and agricultural community that was, you know, decimated by the things people did to the land and by the shifts, the economic shifts, industry moving out of the country, not just out of that part of the state, and the land being spent. Hmm. You know, the economy basically up and left. So people are much more stuck there than they were before, though they may have felt stuck there before. People are still attached to their home. It's home. It smells like home. It looks like home. It's their sky, their blackbirds, their deep black soil, the rivers they know, the trees they know, the seasons, the dogwoods. The Crowley's Ridge is an important landmark to people, which used to be a big fruit-growing ridge, which no longer is. There's not much industry left.
T.D. Wright, what does it mean that this history comes out of a poet? There's a sort of mixture of media in this book, one with others, but the poetry world and the critics obviously love it.
I think people are receptive to the fact that the genres are, they're not exactly porous, they're not exactly fluid, but certainly people are going at things in more than one way. And I think people who read and write prose miss poetry in their lives. And I think poets are tired of the isolation of poetry. And I think the documentary record has a lot to yield that creative writers can explore and put a different lens on those facts.
So this book is in places a collage of Dear Abby columns or court documents or public orders or whatnot. Give us an example of the mix of the you and the documents, so to speak.
I thought this was a town that has and still has a daily newspaper. And a daily newspaper, however well or poorly it's written, this is pretty good newspaper, dates a place like almost nothing else I can think of, you know. The advertisements date a place, the kinds of opinions that are written date a place, the headlines, the way the headlines are stated, food prices and food brands date a place.
Here are some of the prices. You write, the only sure thing in those days were the prices. Jack Sprat tea bags, only 19 cents. A whole fryer is 59 cents. A half gallon of Purex, 25 cents. 2 pounds of Oleo, 25 cents. Ivory soap, 10 cents a bar. Cherokee Freestone peaches, 5 cans for a dollar. And then there's Dear Abby.
Right. This one, I think, is very telling of the time. Dear Abby, when Daryl and I were first married, he asked me to iron his undershorts. His mother always did. At first, I didn't mind because we had no children, but now have two, and I could save a lot of time tossing them in the dryer and folding them. But I tried that once, and I never heard the end of it. Daryl says he could feel the difference. What would you do? Dear Too Much Ironing, I would iron his underwear. You're wasting more energy complaining and arguing than it takes to iron 7 pairs of shorts once a week. Everybody has a problem. What's yours?
Let's hear it for the language of Arkansas, C.D., including your own. What's to say about the language of Arkansas?
It's biblical. It's idiomatic. It has its cadence that's very common in the South, which is fairly lyrical for English, I would say. It's rife with humor, and which I've often found about places that are kind of low on the totem pole, so to speak, that humor is a very effective weapon and also a way to get through the day. And I think it's also driven by the music, the soundtrack of that part of the world, I would say, is mostly country and down-home blues. And the early rhythm and blues is cut right out of that part of the world, you know, Memphis, the Memphis sound, all the way up the Delta, all the way down to the Gulf. And it was very rich right around this town. Very, very rich, that sound. And it just yielded a lot of very raw, very original songwriters. Sadell Davis is from there, Sonny Boy Williamson, The Silver Fox, Johnny Cash, Elvis is from near there, Johnny Taylor. All of these people created a description of that world, you know, of the economy of that world, of that landscape, of, you know, the sound of the trains, of the rhythms of the work. they really are the literary legacy of that part of the country.
C.D. Wright, this history, one with others, is, of course, also a large piece of your history. How do you feel that your own course was bent by, A, the civil rights movement in Arkansas, and then by V?
I don't think I ever would have written if it hadn't been for V, because she was the one who made it all seem alive to me. And even though I grew up as a heavy reader, as my father did before me, and we had a lot of books in my house, imagination was inimical to my father. He really only liked actual things. And it wasn't until I was around V that I felt like she released my imagination. And her love of literature was so profound that I don't know that it gave me confidence, but it gave me it fed my dream. And civil rights, I think, was important to all of us who, regardless of whether we were participants or not, which I wasn't until I was a student in Memphis, but by then, and Martin Luther King was already dead, and we were moving into the anti-war activity at that point. So I don't know who wasn't affected by it. It was the major movement of my youth, and until it started moving into the Vietnam War and of course women's rights. All of those movements were all right on top of each other, interfacing with each other, and I just don't know anyone who wasn't affected by it. It was not just the background, it was the ground from which we came.
Fit this CD in by now a large body of poetic work. In what sense has this been sort of cooking for 40 years?
I had always wanted to honor her, really. Everybody should get to know someone like her. You know, someone that just is not going to be assimilated. And I was quite thrilled by my friendship with her and all of my friends. We were all 15, 20 years younger than her. We were all her acolytes, which she totally didn't want, though she enjoyed our friendship. Every once in a while, it would occur to her to say, I'm too old to be friends with you all. And we would say, it's too late. You know, we're a tribe.
She described herself as a disaffiliated member of her race.
Well, I described her that way. She was certainly isolated by her town. She was already isolated by the fact that she had no income of her own and had all these children. But she was very isolated by the events of 1969. So she owned that. She owned that disaffiliation. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say she resented it. It was a principle and a point of pride.
Mm-hmm. C.D. Wright, you've rendered a history and created this character that more and more people are going to get to know. It's been such a pleasure to read One with Others, and something extra to hear you talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm really glad I wrote this book.
I can tell.
I hope I get another opportunity to write something that gave me as much pleasure as it has. To have written it, to write it, was very frustrating. I just didn't think I was going to get it. I almost gave up several times. I just didn't think I could make all the parts coalesce. But finally, I just surrendered to whatever process it was that I thought I had concocted, and decided I'd taken it as far as I could. And afterwards, I finally felt pleased with it.
The judgment is you'd done it, but can you describe the turning point when you knew you had it and what it was?
I had a paragraph I had written early on, and I never had a place for it. And I liked the paragraph. It was sort of the sum of everything that was in the book that I thought I was going to write. It was just a paragraph, but it sort of was the whole thing. I kept thinking I should throw this away. I'm too dependent on it, and I don't have a place for it. And finally, I put it at the very end, almost as a coda, but not. It doesn't announce itself as a coda. And when I think when I wrote that, I thought I think I'm done. I think I've got it, sort of. And this is the last passage. I'm standing in a sluggish line at the Memphis airport. It is too early. A little girl in a pink sweatsuit with tawny corkscrew curls stands behind me. I wish you would just shut up, she says to the stuffed bear she holds. Her mother and I exchange holy moly looks. I sway between standing and falling. I am flashing the black paintings before they were transferred onto canvas, and a cock called Helmet, Sweet Baby J.C., a frowsy bush of Sweet Betsy, and an old activist with the sobriquet Sweet Willie Wine. There are endless rows of cotton and never enough shade or cool, cool water, and rivers silting up and slowing to a standstill. Daytime bourbon drinkers, smelly shirts and scrap dogs, clouds of malathion and moccasins in the storm cellar, muscles as big as dinner dishes, a land of layoffs and morbid obesity, sharp-tongued undertakers, don't-pick-up-hitchhikers correction facility signs, gentlemen who could not be called gentlemen without it coming back on them, women who could never be called ma'am, rusted iron bridges, towheads, do-rags, tired-out schoolbooks, kids put in a drained pool, a pool buried and paved over, brothers scared shitless jumping off an overpass to get away from armed, malevolent men, brothers hiding under the preacher's pickup, blackbirds flashing their red shoulders, speckled bowling balls, segregation after death, and how the death of reason produces monsters.
Thank you, C.D. Wright.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.